was always kind of taught to dream big and think like a leader.
How can we hack the system?
We are producers to its core. We're makers.
That was that moment where I was like, yes, like this was a big one to put us on the map.
Creativity is messy. Perfect is boring.
That to me is good creative. That to me is success.
You can see talent in people.
We want to go create the next best brand in the world.
This is who we are and this is what we do.
This is Creatives Off Script. Lex Hallaby is the creative director at Portal A, where he works extensively in XR, a combination of virtual reality, augmented reality, and mixed reality, to create content on the bleeding edge of innovation. With a background as a professional film director, he now leads Portal A's in-house team of writers and directors to create memorable content and experiences, such as YouTube's Pokemon Go Fest with the Try Guys, Google's YouTube series with Bill Nye, and Snapchat's Action Royale. Welcome to our show, Lex.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Awesome. So one of the great things about Creatives Off Script is we really get to hear all the various journeys about how people became successful, and every single journey is unique. And so I'd love to start from the beginning and learn a little bit about your history. I know that your parents were Palestinian refugees that fled to America. Would love to know like how that impacted your upbringing and really maybe how that got you into the line of work that you're in today.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm first generation. I was born in Berkeley, California, middle of three boys. And yeah, I mean, when you grow up with immigrant parents, you sort of have like one foot in each culture, and you're kind of constantly context switching, you know, and I think that kind of plays into creativity. I think you do that a lot in creativity. And, you know, having grown up in that environment and with two brothers, it's kind of a hotbed for creativity because there's just constant back and forth with my brothers and within the family. And, you know, it played into my identity early on and certainly like kind of gave me an outsider lens to a lot of things, which, you know, through my career, I think I've found ways to bring that into my work, sometimes a bigger challenge than others. But yeah, I think it definitely kind of informed a lot of my formative years when I started looking towards being in a creative field.
And so I believe you went to film school at UCLA. Did you know you wanted to be a director at that point? Like how early did you decide on that?
Yeah, pretty early on. I knew I wanted to be in film. You know, I kind of come from a family of tinkerers in a lot of ways. And my grandfather was one of the like early adopters of video. He used to come to family gatherings with one of those huge kind of video cameras that had a side mounted VCR to it. And, you know, he kind of got me interested in that very early on. And my parents were super supportive. And my brothers and I would make videos together, usually like action series kind of videos, sometimes comedy. And we, you know, we made God knows how many, I mean, 50, 60 of these sort of like short films growing up, and all the neighborhood kids would play roles. You know, it was every single person on the block and neighborhood would be in them in different ways. So, you know, I would say as I got into high school, I got more serious about it. Definitely wanted to stay in the UC system. UCLA had a great program. And for me, it was kind of a no-brainer to try to make that happen. So yeah, I went to UCLA. It's a 2-year program. It's like the second half of your bachelor's of your 4 years. You enter into the film program. So I kind of did my general ed first, but applied, thankfully got in. And yeah, it was kind of off to the races. That was the plan from maybe the time I was like 7, 8 years old.
Yeah. I hear that story from some other people that their earliest collaborators were their siblings and they're the kids in the neighborhood. Curious if any of those other kids you grew up with ended up continuing to collaborate with you throughout your career?
You know, it's interesting. Most of them have gone into other fields, but you know, there was this moment as I got older and people's interests started to change that I felt like my filmmaking group was kind of falling apart. You know, one ended up going into being a programmer. My brother became an architect, you know, different fields. And I was sort of trying to find like a new tribe of creative people to sort of bond with and have that sort of creative energy. So I would say once I came down to LA, I was sort of trying to recreate that. And that's a lot of what film school actually gave me, maybe less so like the hands-on side and more finding like-minded creatives that just wanted to make cool stuff and, you know, work together and play every role that's needed to make it happen. So that was really kind of the big win for me, is finding my tribe when I came down here.
Yeah, film school is great for that. Definitely something I missed out on in my career. So coming out of film school, you then go on to be a freelance director for 17 years. I'd love to learn more about that experience. Was that by choice or necessity? And how was that freelancing career?
Yeah, when I came out of film school, I decided pretty early on that I wanted to do freelance. In the very beginning, I was doing some, you know, post work for like Showtime Networks and things like that. But I was always pursuing freelance directing on the side. And a couple years into it, I decided to just go full freelance. It was not as hard of a decision as it would be now, let's say. I was very aware that like I was living very inexpensively, you know, in an apartment with a lot of people, and kind of figured if I was ever going to do it, now would be the time, because I could, you know, really put all my energy towards getting those jobs. And I had a very low cost of living. I knew if I waited too long and started getting accustomed to a different lifestyle, that I would not be able to do it later in life. So rather than trying to build towards it as a goal, I've just seen so many people fall into the trap of like, oh, I'll go, you know, story produce for 4 or 5 years and then get to directing later or whatever. A lot of times it never happens. You kind of get ingrained with your work and your career. So I said, look, I want to start my career the way I want to end it. I want to direct. I want to be working freelance. So I took the plunge, started in music videos mainly, which was like a very creatively open kind of brief for new directors, especially at the time. So it kind of afforded me the opportunity to really come to creative concepts like with my own voice, with like a blank page. We weren't working off scripts. You get a song, you brainstorm whatever makes you feel, whatever you think is going to be the best imagery to go with it, and you're off to the races. And there's very few filmmaking opportunities like that. So it felt like a really good place to start as a director.
Yeah. And that sounds like you're going to make it at all costs type of decision. Like you weren't going to give yourself the fallback of having the 9-to-5, just going to throw yourself out there and say, I got to make it as a director, or I'm just not going to have food to eat.
Yeah, that was definitely it. A little like too hardcore, actually. It was just so, I was so, so hungry and motivated. I remember like I paid quite a bit at the time. Now you would never even have to buy this, but there was like something called a Polestar. Polestar puts together like names of all like the managers and agents for all the recording artists. And you can like buy it as a book that has like direct contact to a lot of these people. And that was like a big, like I splurged on that because I knew that I wanted to go and like contact pretty much every person on this list and like offer to show them or send them like my reel, you know, see if there were any opportunities to pitch on any of their up and coming artists. And this was before I had any representation. So I was just like hustling by just calling and literally like, you know, an Excel sheet of like, when was the last time I contacted that person? What did they say? Have I sent them a reel? How long ago did I send them a reel? Did I hear back? What kind of budgets were they working with? And just kind of like gathering all that information and building relationships that way. I would say like some managers were like, why is this kid, how did this kid get my number and why does he keep hitting me up? But ultimately, like that would pay off. They would kind of be like, hey, I do have something for you, actually. Like I have this new artist, like if you're interested and want to take a swing at it. So yeah, maybe hungry to a fault, but that felt like my path is just like hit the pavement and just like I knew I would put in the hours. And treat it sort of like a 9-to-5 job, even though it was freelance, just like all day grinding. And, you know, that was kind of how I got my start.
Nice. Speaking of music videos, this is kind of a pet question, but I saw you early on directed a music video for Atmosphere. Definitely an artist I think our generation grew up with. What was that like? What is Slug like in real life?
Yeah, working with Atmosphere was great. You know, that was maybe, that was like maybe my second or third music video very early on. And I just remember thinking this was like a really unique opportunity to do something cool with a hip hop video, because super creative, you know, Slug and Ant, like super creative, and their work that they'd done for visuals for albums and other music videos always stood out to me. So when I was pitching a concept to them, I was thinking, we're not going to do performance. We're not going to do something that you'd maybe expect from an indie hip hop artist. Like, let's just go for it with the biggest swing I can and see if they react to it. And so I pitched them this idea of, you know, a homeless man getting his 15 minutes of fame while Slug is going into a record shop to buy some records. And it's kind of, it's a surreal music video. It's shot super high speed as paparazzi are basically chasing him around town, and super slow motion shots of him running and getting chased and ultimately like sort of getting mugged and attacked by the paparazzi. And that at the time, like looking at it now, that type of music video is much easier to shoot. The technology is here to shoot it digitally with a Phantom or a whole other series of cameras. But at the time it was with the Photosonics Action Master 500. So it's actually shooting film at 500 frames a second, which is very costly. You can't play it back. You can basically get one take of everything. So creatively, it required a lot of pre-viz and a lot of thinking through, like, how are we going to execute everything, and a lot of faith that it's going to be developed properly and look great. And, you know, very happy with how that video came out. And it actually kind of opened my doors to representation and to a lot of record labels.
Amazing. What would you say was the hardest part of your career? Biggest challenge that you had to overcome?
Yeah, I think the hardest part for me was getting to work with artists that were like aligned with my creative voice. I think early on, I was so hungry. It's like I would take any job, right? I just wanted opportunities to get behind the camera and, regardless of the artist, find a way to do something new or creative with it. But that's sort of a double-edged sword. Like, you get the experience, but sometimes you start going down a path where you're directing in a genre of music that doesn't always like align to your creative taste. And for me, like, I did a lot of metal and like hardcore stuff very early on. Like, that was a challenge, is like trying to curve my career towards the types of artists and music that like I found more inspirational. And it took a long time, and it took working with my reps and, you know, just pitching on a lot of projects where people would go, yeah, I mean, we love your idea, but you've done a bunch of this like other hard rock stuff, or, you know, how would you approach this? So I think that was probably the biggest challenge, is finally getting to work with artists that spoke to me more.
Yeah, I would agree. I think that's one of the hardest things about the creative industry in general, is you really do just get pigeonholed with, what have you done in the past? You know, do more of that, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you mentioned that the Atmosphere music video helped you get management. What was the first like big break in terms of getting a, you know, top management or representation?
Yeah, I think so. Early on with Atmosphere, that showed at some festivals, actually. I think it was in like some of these LA music festivals at the time. And that's a couple reps that were like on panels at the festival, saw it, was in the audience, and had reached out to me for representation, which, you know, nowadays is maybe not as important. It's like very easy for people to see your work on social media or like, you know, through other avenues and be a fan and connect. At the time, there was like gatekeeping from the label side. They would just work with representatives and rosters at production companies. So it was a little bit more structured. So that was a big step for me, is just like getting access to the labels at the commissioner level to get to know them, start to show them what I can do, and really start to build those relationships that, you know, would pay off down the line.
And what would you say was the biggest, like, first win of your career in terms of a job you won or a piece of work you did where you felt like, okay, I've made it. Like, I am a top tier director in this industry.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I don't know if I've ever had like felt like I had that moment. Usually what would happen with me is anytime I'd book a big job, it took me many years to realize that I wouldn't celebrate the wins. I would be like, this is great, but I want to be doing X. And I never took that beat to be like, I've arrived, I'm a working director. I kind of was always looking for the next thing, maybe to a fault. This has been a problem in my career throughout my life. I have many unopened bottles of champagne that were bought or given to me to celebrate something, and I never got around to opening them because I'm just too focused on whatever job I just booked and making sure it goes well. So yeah, I wouldn't say that there's any one given moment, but there are moments where I really felt like I was in my element and loving what I was doing and feeling like my creative voice was really aligned with my work. And maybe surprisingly, it was on smaller projects, or maybe not surprisingly, but the smaller projects were the ones that really popped for me and I was most proud of and probably have done the best for me in the long run in terms of people recognizing the kind of work that I do.
And nowadays you operate as a director and creative director. When did that transition start to happen where you began becoming a true creative director as well?
Yeah, after I was working in music videos for a long time, I started doing more branded work that sometimes was in documentary, sometimes just straight commercials or promos for VH1 and, you know, channels like that sort of had a very visual angle to them. Once I had started doing more branded work and commercials, I realized that's a place I really loved, especially when it came to the more technical job. I loved problem solving. I loved using new technology in interesting ways. I love sort of those risks, those first ever kind of approaches to content, trying things that hadn't been done or seen before. I think that was one of the main reasons why I started doing a lot of work in VR and XR, which started around 2013, 2014. You know, I got my hands on an Oculus development kit, the first one available, and made a homemade 360 camera and started stitching and shooting videos, and then later got it more into real-time and volumetric video and AR. And from that, you know, I think that sort of really made me realize, like, part of this, like, technical and problem-solving itch in my brain that was getting scratched could really be valuable in a branded or agency space. So it's not, surprisingly, there's not as big of a difference as I thought there'd be when I was transitioning from freelance directing to creative directing at Portal A, because there really is, like, you're still in it from day one all the way through delivery, working on branded, and you're still, that creative part of your brain is still churning the entire time. So it was something that seemed like a really natural fit for me for where I was in my career.
Producers, are you sick of messy projects, outdated calendars, hundreds of email chains, and lost files? Have you dreamed of one tool that can bring your entire production workflow together in one place? Assemble is the project management platform designed by producers for producers, featuring calendars, task lists, call sheets, asset management, and more. Assemble helps industry-leading production companies, agencies, and brands streamline their content production workflow. Try Assemble today using the code OFFSCRIPT, that's one word, to get your first month free. Learn more at assemble.tv. You are listening to the Creatives OFFSCRIPT podcast. So after 17 years of freelance, you now landed at Portal A, your leading creative strategy team. How did you get connected with Portal A and how did that role come about?
Yeah, I'd worked with Portal A as a director from the time the company was, you know, three people essentially in different directing capacities. They've now since grown, you know, to nearly 30 people. But over the years, I, having worked with them and directed projects with them, just became very familiar with the company as they grew and everybody there. When directing, I kind of was slotted into the company at a few levels because Portal A really both works as like a creative agency and a production company. So when I was working as a director, I kind of got to use the sort of agency brain and the director brain and really loved that. I loved that about the company, that you kind of can see a concept all the way through and not pass the baton at any point. You're kind of owning it creatively. So, you know, with COVID-19 and working from home, I started doing more creative development work and even remote directing with them and the broader team. And it just seemed like a really good fit. And just knowing that I loved everybody at the company and really enjoyed the projects I work with them kind of made it a no-brainer when the opportunity came up to join the team as creative director and head of creative.
And now that you've seen both sides of the table, what would you say is your favorite thing about being independent, being a freelancer?
Yeah, from the freelance side, there's a lot of great things about being a freelancer. I think one of them is being able to choose who you're working with, your team. There's definitely sort of a scramble. A lot of times you're coming in a little bit later in the process, depending on the type of project you're on. And being able to bring your team together is always exciting. You're working with different people a lot. And so that's something that is always fun in freelance. If you don't like a client or you don't like somebody you're working with, you don't work with them again. You find ways around that. So being able to pick and choose your project really allows you to sort of keep your voice intact. I also think there's a real power to giving yourself the time to be creative between projects and being able to refill your creative gas tank, so to speak. Freelance allows for that and kind of allows creativity to move at whatever pace you need it to. You may come off a really challenging project and need to recharge your battery and need more downtime, and you can do that. So you know when the next project comes around, you're ready to go and you're inspired and you're your best creative self. So I think that's a big part of it. I think that is where you really win on the creative side, is being able to move at the pace of your creativity and not force it on anyone else's timeline.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And what would you say is your favorite thing about being in-house?
Yeah, being in-house is great because you have a team. If you love your team like I do, you develop a shorthand. You start learning about different people's creative voices and being able to really like leverage that and manage that. There's a camaraderie that you build over time. So, you know, whereas in freelance, you might be, there's a benefit to being able to assemble your team and choose your team day to day. You know, if you are with the right team, like I feel like I am at Portal A, you kind of have that built in every day, which is great. From a personal side, you know, I have a 5-month-old baby, and working from home is big benefit to me. When I was freelance, I was traveling a lot and shooting all over the country and world, and being able to work from home and spend time with my family while doing that has also been really valuable.
And speaking of team, Portal A has a big in-house team, strategists, writers, designers, directors. Do you all produce everything in-house from start to finish?
Yeah, Portal A is really interesting in that we're involved very early on in the creative process when a client comes to us, from ideation to casting, all the way through production. Typically, we are doing the productions. So both agency and production company, all the way through to delivery, you know, we do in-house. So yeah, we have, like you said, we have a pretty broad team of creatives and designers and team talent and producers. And almost every project we fully do in-house. I think that's very much sort of the magic sauce of the company, is we don't just come in and pinch hit on one part of the process. We own the process from beginning to end.
And you mentioned it a few times, so I might be a bit of a rookie here, but what is XR exactly by your definition?
Yeah, with the sort of resurgence of virtual reality, sort of the newest incarnation of it, there were a lot of R's that came with VR. So there's VR, AR, MR, and XR is sort of everything R, kind of putting it all under one roof. And when I say R, the R stands for reality. So it's sort of, you know, blended realities, mixed realities, augmented reality, virtual reality. But it's all immersive technology, more or less. And that's a place, it's a passion of mine and a place that did a lot of work, especially in the early days of the newer technologies, was breaking into the forefront and working with brands a lot to bring their first VR, AR projects to light, because there was a huge knowledge gap when brands knew they wanted to do something in the space, but did not know even what it was or how to do it. So that's a lot of where I came in to both educate and also, you know, produce, direct those projects.
And why is it such a passion for you? What do you love about XR?
Yeah, there's something from the very early days, even when people were talking about VR in the 90s, it's just like, it always captures people's imagination. I would say up until recently, it has basically been an imagined technology. And now we're starting to see what the technology can truly do. I think a lot of people, maybe with this newest advent of VR, this new generation of VR, may look at it and go, that's a gimmick. That's come and gone. But I liken it to like very early on gaming consoles. You know, you had arcades in the 70s and 80s, and they were really popular. And then you had these, you had an Atari, you know, you had an Atari 800, an Atari 2600. And there was like, everybody would go, well, this isn't as good as the arcade. You know, it's like very few people would have it. It was expensive. It didn't really get mass adoption until later with the advent of like Nintendo Entertainment System. We're not quite there yet, but with the pace at which, you know, machine vision and machine learning is going, we're going to get there sooner than I think people think. And there's going to be a tipping point with the technology where suddenly it just clicks and it makes sense and you can have mass adoption.
And what does that look like too? What does the future of XR look like?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different ways it can go. I think right now there's sort of a battle for, you know, AR glasses that a lot of people have been kind of vying for, a lot of top secret projects that are constantly being buzzed about. The idea is to be able to overlay imagery tracked into your environment through glasses in front of your eyes, which can either be really amazing in terms of like being informational and helpful and providing new, interesting entertainment experiences, or it can be just straight dystopian horror show. I mean, we're kind of at the razor's edge of it. But my hope is that it can open up like really interesting educational opportunities, communication opportunities, you know, entertainment when it comes to storytelling. All of that, I think, can be baked into AR and VR. I'm sure there will be also like, you know, advertising and branding and things that make its way into it. And we're just going to have to find a way to make sure that doesn't like pollute the sort of new overlay of reality, you know, whether you call that the metaverse or something else. There's a lot of different words for it. But, you know, if we can kind of keep that at bay, I think there's tremendous potential.
Yeah, it's going to be an exciting future ahead. So I just got a couple quick questions for you here. Just going to shoot these off rapid fire. What's the most influential book you've read or film you've seen?
The most influential movie I've seen was Back to the Future, because that really actually made me want to be a filmmaker. That was just ticked so many boxes in my young mind that it made me just go, this is what I want to do.
And was it the story of it, the production of it? Like, what grabbed you about that film?
Yeah, I mean, Back to the Future is kind of like this amazing intersection of science fiction, which I love, and action films, which I love, and comedy, which I love. It's just kind of like the perfect blend of probably three of the most sort of inspirational types of films that I grew up with. It's a movie where, when you look at it in retrospect, is pretty bonkers. You have like an old scientist hanging out with this high school kid who goes back in time, and his mom falls in love with him. And like, by modern standards, if you're talking about that movie, it seems like, okay, maybe it's some weird like Adult Swim animated thing. You know, maybe it's like more like Rick and Morty or something, but it wasn't that way. It was like family entertainment at the time. And when you look at it like through a modern lens, it's still hugely entertaining, if not a little odd, but I love it for that. And I pray that they never remake it. And Zemeckis has said that he'll never allow it to be remade, but you never know what happens when, you know, multinational conglomerates buy up rights to things. So I really hope that is one that never gets touched.
Yeah, it's like the definition of classic. Which one are you picking as the best, number one, two, or three?
I think the best Back to the Future is the first one, mainly because just the fact that movie got made is pretty amazing. It is It's an amazing screenplay. Almost every single line in the first 10 minutes of that movie pays off in the third act. So, you know, when you look at it, having seen the movie, I don't know how many times, 50 times, you start seeing that where it's like every little line is a seed that's planted that comes back to, you know, fruition when Marty goes back in time and ultimately pays off in the third act. The screenplay is so tight. Yeah, it's kind of a masterclass, and I'm surprised it doesn't get brought up as much in screenwriting classes or by writers, but it's a phenomenal screenplay.
Yeah, I was always a fan of number two, but I think that was just because of the hoverboard.
Yeah, see, that was the thing. Actually, when I was a kid, number two, I probably would have said number two because I loved futuristic stuff when I was a kid, and I wanted a hoverboard more than anything. But as I got older, sort of recognizing what the first one was doing, I really got to appreciate it. And then the third one is again, like, it's kind of a home run. It ticks all the boxes. You do start to see some of the formula emerge a bit more by three. So maybe there wasn't like as much like fresh storytelling, but the setting and the world, and again, like a really tight script and amazing performances. I mean, Michael J. Fox is such like a physical comedian. He really brought that role to life.
And so what are you reading or watching these days?
Yeah, I mean, now that I have a small child, baby, it's hard to find time to watch much stuff or read much. If I read now, I will very quickly fall asleep. So that I haven't really had as much time to do that. But I will say the last book I read, shameless plug, was my mom recently had a book come out about three generations of Palestinian women in my family called In My Mother's Footsteps. And reading that while looking at my very young son has been an emotional experience because it really tracks my family lineage through letters written between my mom and her mom as my mom traveled back to Palestine to look for our ancestral home. You know, that had a profound impact on me, many tears shed. So that was the last book I read just a couple months ago. And then in terms of like watching, I haven't really had time. I've been playing some video games here and there in my small little downtime, but nothing much in the watching space.
Yeah, it sounds like a really powerful book.
Yeah, I mean, it's a book she'd been working on for a really long time. And, you know, it's amazing to finally see it, you know, come to light, and it's been received really well. So I'm a very proud son.
That's great. So aside from XR and your newborn, what else are you really passionate about?
Yeah, let's see. I really love immersive theater. Immersive theater, you know, all the immersive arts, obviously, anybody that's in the XR space should be in immersive theater. But I think that's a space that has been really hit hard by COVID, but I fully expect it to bounce back. People are really looking for experiences, not just purchasing digital goods. Like, sure, we can have streaming services or whatever it may be, but like actually physically going somewhere and experiencing something firsthand, there feels like there's more a premium on it than ever, you know, and COVID has kind of put a hiccup in that, but I feel like it's gonna come back. So definitely passionate about immersive theater, and I'm really passionate about video games. That's like an area, the interactive arts, that I've always been interested in and loved, and been playing video games since I was very young. And, you know, I know in the early days they were kind of treated as something just for kids, but I think finally it's come around to where people can really see the art behind them. Indie games are bigger than ever. Access to them is easy and inexpensive, and development has gotten much less expensive. So you're seeing, you know, auteurs in the space start to evolve, one person teams, and that's really exciting.
Yeah. Speaking of immersive theater, can you give me an example of that? Like, what's the best immersive theater experience that you've seen?
Yeah, immersive theater, a few of my favorites. I mean, there's obviously Sleep No More in New York, which kind of put immersive theater on sort of the global map, which is a fantastic multi-level experience, tens if not hundreds of actors, hundreds of participants that can freely roam the space and follow actors. And it's loosely based on Hamlet. So, you know, it's, that's an amazing experience. Love that. It's in New York, but out here in LA, there's Blue Blade, which is a really great immersive theater series. That's got a little bit of everything. It's got some sci-fi. It's got some Indiana Jones in there too. So that's a fantastic one that I hope picks up again here in LA. And then I had a very interesting immersive experience called Red Flags, which was a Fringe Fest winner. And Red Flags is immersive theater for one. So the idea is it's just you and an actor on this experience together. And they are playing a character. You are yourself. You don't know where it's going. But the general concept is you go on a really bad first date. That's why it's called Red Flags. So it starts with like texting with the person, and there's like some backstory and some weird stuff starting to come through, and you meet up, you know, in LA, and you know, she showed up late, and if there was some weird reasons why, and sort of as this date evolved, all these kind of red flags started appearing, and it, you know, became very interesting and awkward and kind of puts you on the spot in a lot of ways to participate and help sort of tell the story of where this bad date is going. And so that's like, that's an example of something that is pretty out there. And when I tell people that, they're like, wait, you paid to go on a bad date? But it really is like an experience you can't replicate in any other way. Thankfully, my wife was cool with me going there. I asked her, like, can I pay to go on a date with somebody for this theater experience? Are you okay with that? And she was like, yeah, go for it. That sounds weird, but I want to hear how it goes. So I did.
That's really crazy, actually, to think about. So it's a theater for one, essentially, and you're meeting up with this paid actor who is creating this performance for you.
Yeah, and it sort of blurs the line between scripted and unscripted in that, you know, they are that same character with every person. They have the same backstory, but it's very smart in how it helps weave in your story into it. There are questions in the conversation that come up that sort of forces you to play along into the fiction of it, of how you met this person and how you got their number and things like that, where you're kind of like sowing some of those seeds and it becomes a creative collaboration. And somebody who loves, you know, D&D and tabletop role-playing games, like it's that sort of like writing in real time is very exciting and very fun to do.
That's fascinating. So last question, looking back on your career now and all the success that you've had, what advice would you give to your 20-year-old self?
Yeah, if I were to kind of go back in time and give my 20-year-old self advice, beyond telling myself to buy as much Bitcoin as I could, which I probably would tell myself, my 20-year-old self.
Back to the Future reference there.
Yeah, there you go. You know, I'd be like, just buy, whenever this comes about, just buy as much as you can. Yeah, I would say to keep writing. I think that's like a really valuable skill. And there was a time in my life where I got so busy with directing that I didn't write as much. And to me, as I got older, I kind of realized that to continue being a good director, you have to be able to write and you have to be able to look at storytelling, regardless of whether it's a branded series or, you know, or a fully original series, or even a, you know, a 30-second broadcast spot. It's all storytelling, and just understanding the connection between what's on the page and what's in front of our eyes is so valuable. You know, I went to UCLA for screenwriting and I made that choice early on of like, I know I can direct and I know I will direct, but I want to take this time to learn the craft of writing and storytelling on the page. And as I got older, you know, I started to sort of turn a little bit more towards the directing side. And it's taken me a while to get back into the, you know, getting my writing chops back. So I would say just always write and keep writing and never lose that, so it never leaves your side.
It's a difficult thing to do. It's like lifting weights, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Once that muscle starts to atrophy, it's like much harder to get it back. And yeah, your writing muscles get sore. You start getting like, you know, fatigue, or you might lose kind of how your flow and your inspiration came about. And just like making sure you understand how to tap into that and doing the work, you know, that's the biggest thing, is set aside time, sit down. That is your writing time. Doesn't matter if you write one word or you write, you know, 10 pages of a script. If you're sitting down every day and thinking on it, you're writing. And just, it's really like building that discipline into your life and maintaining that discipline is key.
Definitely. Well, thanks so much for joining us. Really excited to see what the future holds for you, especially in this immersive new world. And really enjoyed our conversation.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it as well. Thank you so much for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and comment to help us spread the word. You can also find more insider content on the Assemble blog, and you can find me on all channels at Nate Watkin. And don't forget, if your producing team is in need of a project management solution, try Assemble today to streamline your production workflow. Our listeners received their first month free by utilizing the code OFFSCRIPT, that's one word, at checkout. You have been listening to the Creatives Offscript podcast hosted by Assemble.